From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. The general election campaign is well underway. John McCain and Barack Obama face more scrutiny than ever before. But what about their wives? How will the images of Michelle Obama and Cindy McCain affect the candidates' run for the White House? Joining me now to explore these questions are Gina McCauley, who runs the website MichelleObamaWatch.com, and Judy Muller, an associate professor of journalism at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Let's start with this one. We're going to talk about both Michelle Obama and Cindy McCain, but let's begin with Michelle Obama. Gina, you're running an entire blog monitoring her. Why are you doing that?
Well, I have another blog. My first blog is called What About Our Daughters? And one of our founding principles is that we fight the negative portrayal of African-American women in popular culture. And I started to get so many emails and complaints from my readers specifically dealing with Michelle Obama, that I feared that over the course of the general election campaign, I'd be doing a Michelle Obama post every day, and I didn't want to overshadow all of the other important issues we cover on What About Our Daughters. So, and I also didn't have the time to keep track of everything going on with Michelle Obama, so I decided to set up a separate blog that's completely staffed by volunteer contributors, and that's the reason why there's a separate blog just dedicated to her, because I don't know that we've ever seen an African-American woman that's going to receive the amount of sustained media scrutiny that she will between now and November. And also, I was a little bit miffed that there didn't seem to be a better defense of her on some of these issues that have taken root and they're still dealing with, such as her statements regarding her pride in her country and the fact that hope was on a comeback, and then this ludicrous rumor that eventually spread to cable television about her using the word whitey on videotape. And I just felt like people weren't properly addressing those. That's one of the reasons we have the blog.
All right, let me stop you there I want to bring Judy into the conversation as well, but you mentioned something that I want to hit on, talking about the media scrutiny of Michelle Obama. As we all know, yesterday she appeared on ABC's The View television show to kick off what some are calling a campaign to soften her image. We're going to talk about that in just a moment, but here's a clip of Michelle Obama's appearance on that show yesterday.
When you put your heart out there, there's a level of passion that you feel, and it's a risk that you take.
Of course.
But one of the things I'm counting on is that people will see through it.
Yeah.
You know, that the more they get to know me, they get to know our family, that it'll become clear who I am and what I care about. So I don't worry about it.
Judy Miller, two things. Is this an attempt, do you think, to create a softer image for Michelle Obama, and does she need one?
Well, I think that's an interesting comment, because I think the idea that they're out to create a softer image has been created somewhat by the mass media, starting with the New York Times yesterday. And in fact, on The View, Barbara Walters held up the headline and read it to her and said, "Is this what's going on?" And I think she kind of laughed at that. She said, "You know, I am who I am." I thought she handled it very well and said, "You know, I am who I am, and I think when people get to know me..." I don't think she came across as saying, "I'm not out here in a calculated campaign to put across an image. My image is who I am." And now, you can argue with that, because all campaigns are conscious of image, for sure, and the Obama campaign is no different. But I think she really wants to make it clear that she is genuine. Remember, Cindy McCain also went on The View, and that was when she was in trouble over stealing recipes of all things from Rachel Ray. I mean, you know, like this, it gets so silly. You know, really, is the bump with the fist? Is that what does that mean? And does Cindy McCain steal recipes? Oh my gosh! I mean, it really is so absurd. And I think it's going to get more absurd, quite frankly. I'm not sanguine about the next few months.
Well, you know, Cindy McCain is in Vietnam this week, and Gina, she actually talked to ABC News in a fairly rare interview with Kate Snow. Here's a clip from that interview. Let's hear it.
I've led my life differently, and I have never been... I'm not the candidate. I've never been front
thank
and center.
You, Cindy,
I do the things that I enjoy, and I do the things that are important to me. and do them in the way that I like to do them.
So is this consistent with what we know about Cindy McCain, or is this an attempt to somehow massage her image?
Well, if you're asking me...
I was going to ask Gina first and then come back to you. Gina?
Yeah, I think what we don't know about Cindy McCain could fill volumes. And I think that we, in a way, know more about Michelle Obama. Cindy McCain has been fairly or unfairly sort of cast as a Stepford wife kind of person. I think there's probably a lot more to her than that, as there are with all human beings. But she's been very careful, I think, to be the supportive wife. The fact that she's, you know, a multimillionaire in her own right isn't brought up much. I really think that she's made a conscious effort to be in the background of her husband's campaign.
Gina, do you? I'd like to get your response to that, and also to tack on to that question whether or not you think that Michelle Obama has to position herself in some way against Cindy McCain.
Well, I think with Hillary Clinton, she kind of marked the first time that you had, in my lifetime that I can remember, I'm fairly young, I haven't been through too many presidential elections, but she marked the first time where there was a woman who was married to the presidential candidate, who had a career that was equal to, or in some cases when it came to making money, was greater than that of her husband's. And I think you're seeing the same phenomenon with Michelle, and they are lawyers, and so they're out there and they're speaking as they would anyway. And I think Cindy McCain is taking a, quote, more traditional role in her husband's campaign to kind of be the adoring spouse that, you know, applauds him, but really isn't out there necessarily being one of his campaign surrogates in the same way that Michelle Obama is when she's making her argument for Barack Obama to be the next president of the United States. So, and I think that may be one of the reasons why we don't know as much about Cindy McCain as we, you know about Michelle Obama. She hasn't really been made a target of the campaign. I one of the things that bothered me really early on was it almost seemed as if earlier in the campaign during the primary, Michelle might have been taking more hits than her husband, and she wasn't even a candidate, and that bothered me as well.
Let me jump in with this thought for you, Judy Mueller, and that's this. Is there a model for this? You know, we've had, obviously, women running alongside their husbands. Well, the husbands were running and the women were running alongside of them. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, obviously, there was a flip-flop for that during this primary season. But my question is there a model for the kind of behavior or the appropriateness for the spouse, particularly the female?
Well, yes. I think that, ironically, the model is Hillary Clinton, we were just talking about. I think that Hillary Clinton was a lightning rod in many ways, and she says, I'm not standing by my man sitting around baking some cookies. Well, that had legs forever. I mean, and then she had to revert and say, oh, no, it's okay to bake cookies. I mean, you know, she was the first candidate's wife who really had a very good career on her own, could hold her own right along with the candidate. And I think, obviously, Michelle Obama is that person as well. She carries the added burden of being the first African-American woman.
Yeah.
And I think that is an enormous new territory, and it's fascinating to watch. I think it's exciting, and yet I sort of hold my breath, you know, hoping that it doesn't degenerate into silliness.
Well, do you think that in some ways the candidacy of George Bush, the second George Bush, with Laura Bush, has had some kind of impact on this behavior? You mentioned Hillary Clinton, but do you think that it's changed in any way?
That's really funny, because I was just trying to think, what do I know about Laura Bush, really, other than that she... was a former librarian,
mm-hmm.
is in favor of literacy, you know, watches over her daughter's one who kind of got into trouble there, and then another, you know, the wedding. What do we really know beyond sort of these broad brushstrokes? Not much.
But, you know, her being quiet, so to speak, is a contrast to, say, someone like Teresa Hines Carey, who was a powerful woman in her own right and caused some problems for her husband's campaign. Did she not, Gina?
Yeah, I mean, but any woman who takes on a role that is more similar to Hillary Clinton's role in the 92 campaign versus Laura Bush's role in 2000 is going to come under that scrutiny. Teresa Hines Carey came under that scrutiny. Elizabeth Edwards, had John Edwards been the Democratic nominee, we would be talking about Elizabeth Edwards getting a softer image and being kind of converted into, you know, a homemaker image, and that, because that's the image that we're dealing with. As far as Michelle Obama needing a makeover, I think the racial aspect involved can't be overlooked, with the fact that Michelle Obama really doesn't fit into any of the popular stereotypes about African-American women. And one of the reasons you see newspapers like the New York Times stumbling over their coverage of her is because they're trying to make her fit into boxes that she just doesn't fit in. And that's something, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, you have to hold your breath and wait for somebody else to make a huge faux pas as it relates to Michelle Obama, because not only are they dealing with the issues that they have with career women being engaged and involved in their husband's campaigns, but they're also dealing with the fact that they just don't know what to do with a woman like Michelle Obama. And so they've tried to put her in this box of being this angry black woman, or put her in this box of having this strong personality that needs to somehow be made over. But I don't see anything that Michelle Obama has done on the campaign trail that indicates to me that she isn't a soft person, that she isn't compassionate, that she doesn't love her country. So
right.
Why are we even having this discussion about making her over?
Yeah, I really
got about 10 seconds, Judy, for you to answer that.
Pardon me?
I said we've got about 10 seconds for you to respond
okay.
to that.
I think the power of this couple is that they transcend race, and that, you know, in many ways, she carries that burden, but she also transcends it. And I think that's what's so new here.
Thank you so much. Gina, Judy, thank you a lot. Judy Mueller is an associate professor of journalism at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. And Gina McCauley founded the blog MichelleObamaWatch.com. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Type 2 diabetes, gallstones, cirrhosis. At what age do Americans tend to deal with these medical conditions? 60, 30, maybe even 20 years old. How about 10 years old? With the rising number of overweight and obese children in America, more and more kids are facing medical conditions usually seen in older adults. How did we get to this point, and what can we do to fight childhood obesity? Here to talk about this challenge is Dr. Sandra Moore. She is an assistant professor of clinical pediatrics at the Morehouse School of Medicine. Makani Temba Nixon, she is the executive director of the Praxis Project, a nonprofit organization helping advance health equity and justice. And Alice Smith, program director of Healthy Lifestyles at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. Everyone, welcome to News and Notes.
Hello, Tony.
Dr. Moore, let's start with you.
Yes.
I'd like to ask about statistics, but before I even get into that and how many children are overweight or are obese in this country, what is overweight exactly? How do you know that you're overweight?
Well, the medical community had a standard definition of being overweight, and it really is based on your child's age as well as their gender. And what we do is actually measure their weight and their height, and we compare the two. And so if you weigh more than what is normal for your height, then you're considered overweight. And certainly if you weigh even more, well, then you move into the obese category.
How many children are overweight in America?
Well, that's a very good question, because it really depends on who you're looking at. If you look at all American children across the board from about 2 to 19, about 15 to 16% are actually overweight, with an additional 16% being obese. But if you look at different ethnic groups or different genders, for example, Mexican-American boys, up to 25% of them are overweight, as well as about 25% of all African-American girls.
Overweight. Let me bring Makani in. Do you know why that is? Can you give us an explanation as to why there are those differences?
Well, it's complicated, but I think a lot of it has to do with environmental and historical inequities that then become manifested in our bodies. So many of kids of color do not have access to gym regularly. Their schools are not equipped. They don't have gym teachers. I, for one, my kids was in a gym class with 110 kids with one teacher before they could hire enough. So we have our families dealing with these issues. There are not enough safe places to play and also not enough healthy food that they can access. So part of the struggle is not only to make changes in individual behaviors, which must happen, but a lot of these differences can be explained by looking at the environment.
Well, Alice Smith, you're the program director of Healthy Lifestyles at Children's Healthcare in Atlanta. What concerns you most when you see the increased number of obese children, especially among African Americans?
Well, we're really concerned about the medical conditions that result in childhood, and especially because a lot of parents just don't understand the risk factors and what they mean in terms of developing chronic diseases really early on. We're seeing elementary school kids with high blood pressure, with sleep apnea, with joint and orthopedic problems. We're seeing young kids with type 2 diabetes who go on to have early onset of blindness and kidney problems, some of them going on to kidney dialysis in their 20s. I think you'd mentioned earlier gallstones, non-alcoholic cirrhosis that can result in liver transplants. So this is really a serious concern. And 30 years ago, we weren't seeing this. It just wasn't there in our children. So,
Well, Makani, do you consider this an issue that is primarily laid at the feet of a lack of appropriate health care?
Well, health care is important once you have a problem. But the question is, how can we prevent this? Because much of this is preventable, and especially when we're looking at childhood obesity, which so much of it has to do with access to food and access to play. One of the reasons why we're seeing the increase, there's a whole range of things. Some of it has to do with being able to breastfeed, which also is a real important factor in reducing childhood obesity. How our neighborhoods are organized and the difference in the safety factor. Many of us grew up playing outside, even if we lived in cities, where many kids, their parents are afraid and they're making choices between how much kids exercise and how safe they, you know, want to feel about where their kids are. And they shouldn't really have to make those choices. I think the real key is, yes, we do need to have great access to health care when the problems manifest. But we also have to look at what are the school systems, the school lunches, the places to play, all of those things, so that parents can be supported in making good choices so they're not choosing between being afraid for their kids to play outside and allowing their kids to play and get the exercise that they need. And then also, you know, as we know, that these things accelerate. If it runs in your family, then you're more likely to have these problems. And so then we see this acceleration that we have to figure out how to stop the cycle.
Well, Dr. Moore, as a physician, how much of this can be dealt with at the family level, let's say, in terms of either education or altering harmful practices, things of that sort?
Well, I do want to echo the sentiments of your other guest today in that, you know, it really is a three-pronged approach with policy, communities, families, and even individuals. And so we do want to have a lot of prevention in place, which means making sure that policies are in place so that kids have access to the different activities that will improve their health. In terms of the individual family, we have some programs here that actually work with families to really change the behaviors that have led to overweight. And I was very pleased when you started your segment, you started with the health consequences of overweight, because a lot of people may still believe that them being overweight, we see the physical thing as a problem, but really it's the medical complications that we are concerned about. And so if you can stress to individuals, stress to families, like Ms. Smith mentioned, the consequences they're going to have primarily as young adults or when they're in their 30s, when they're pretty much in the prime of their life, we're very concerned about their quality of life at that point with those chronic diseases.
What changed? You know, we've had obesity issues in the past, but why does it seem to be coming more of it? And I don't want to overstate it, but seeming to be coming more endemic now than before. Dr. Moore.
Well, There are several things that we've already mentioned, one being the environment. And so when you look at video game usage, when you look at computer time usage, when you look at TV viewing, if you look at African Americans, we view more TV and have more what we call screen time than other children. And so if you're looking at TV while you're not outside burning calories, you also want to look at the access to poor nutritional foods, so other words, fast food. And so if you have bargain, quote-unquote, fast food that are very high calories, you combine that with a sedentary lifestyle, and then people can become overweight.
Well, Makani, I'm going to ask you this question because I know that you have all heard the expression baby fat. And it's, oh, she'll grow out of it. He'll grow out of it when he gets to be a teenager, or when he starts growing, or she starts getting taller. It'll all just fall off. There is this sentiment, is there not, in the black community that we can and will grow out of baby fat when, in fact, maybe that's not the case?
Well, there are definitely cultural differences, and those things actually expand not only in the black community, but also in some Latino communities, and also some particularly Pacific Islander communities, where we have different expanded ideas of beauty and body image, which in many ways is very healthy. I think the issue is when we cross those lines and they become unhealthy, you know, because there's a difference between someone being what people say thick, right, mm-hmm. versus, you know, being you know, fat and not able to function. And I think that many folks now understand those differences. They're just not quite sure what to do. So programs like Dr. Moore and other programs, especially when they're in a school site, can really make a difference to help kids figure out how to back down from that cycle. And so in terms of individual behaviors and support by your doctor, if you have a regular doctor, the centers are really important. But also being involved politically to help change those policies and going to like websites like unnaturalcauses.org and that whole PBS series that really has helped people to understand better about how the environment works and how that plays out. And I think I would be remiss not to mention the fact that today is Juneteenth, where around the country in many places, especially in African-American communities that have a large Texan population, folks are acknowledging and celebrating their information. They're getting the news around emancipation from slavery. And the Service Employees International's Union has a project that's a Juneteenth project around health equity to try to engage families in being more involved in the environment and policy work too. So there's a lot of effort nationally to get more people involved, to be educated, to change their behavior, but also change their environment.
I want to follow up on that point with you, Alice, in a moment. But just in case you're just now tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai Jadea. With us, Alice Smith, Program Director of Healthy Lifestyles at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, Dr. Sandra Moore, Assistant Professor of Clinical Pediatrics at Morehouse's School of Medicine, and Makani Timba-Nixon, Executive Director of the nonprofit health advocacy group, the Praxis Project. Alice, I want to come back to you because Makani was just talking about the cooperation that's required both politically, financially, socially, otherwise, to sort of attack this issue of obesity on many fronts. But it would seem to me, and I'd like you to respond to this, that that's a very difficult thing to do, to get all of these sometimes competing interests to work together for the good of our kids.
Well, if you look at it as the whole thing, it could be overwhelming. But if you take it one step at a time, there are many entry points into making a huge impact in the environment or the school. And one is for parents to get involved in their PTA and the school wellness policies that are all over the country now and to become advocates. We have many examples in schools here of individual leadership where parents and the principal or the school nurse have gotten together and they've built walking trails. They've gotten water in their vending machines instead of sodas. They, local people have gotten together with Georgia Organics and the local farmers so that they now have fresh produce from local grown farmers in their schools. So there are many, many ways that people can get involved. Talking with their local restaurants about healthy more healthy choices. Restaurant chains are starting to put heart healthy items on the menu. There are a lot of 10Ks and family walk runs where families can get out together and support different causes in their local communities. So I think that there's a growing awareness of people being willing to step forward, especially families with young children, and get more involved.
Well, Dr. Moore, where should this begin? I know this may seem like a very simple question, but I would imagine that if you're talking about educating and re-educating people with regard to their diet and their healthy exercising and other kinds of practices, that this needs to start like at almost, I won't say the beginning of life, but really close to it, I would think.
Well, you do want to start as early as possible, and you want to start with both the child as well as the family. And one thing in medicine we always say is start with small steps at the beginning. And so sometimes families can feel overwhelmed or feel like they have to do so many different things. But the truth of the matter is, if you start out small, you really can make big changes. And so there are websites to support it, like www.mypyramid.com. But it will list for you healthy foods. It will list suggested calories for children as well as adults. But one thing you want to do is things like eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. Very simple things. You want to drink water instead of drinking juice or regular sodas. You want to do family activities that require moving at least 3 to 5 times a week. And so simple things like that can really start and put you on a path to a healthier you.
The things that you just mentioned, with maybe one exception, don't seem to involve a great deal of expense. Is that a formula for people who, you don't have to have money in order to do this correctly is what I'm getting at. Is that right?
You do not have to have a lot of money to do programs correctly. And I know many patients with limited resources who were able to get moving and to eat better. Now, sometimes you may have some small financial challenges, but you have to think about in the context of your community and in your household, how can you overcome those?
Well, Makani, do you find that there is resistance to that because of, let's say, a stereotype that some of these foods don't taste as good as what people are accustomed to eating, especially in Black households?
Well, you know, I'm finding that people are becoming more and more open to experimenting. A lot of the folks we work with, you know, there's been a lot of great work and websites that have helped people to have healthier soul food. You know, I hear folks talking about new kinds of vegetables, you know, so I'm actually very hopeful. I see people moving in a different direction, eating more fish. And one of the things my grandmother used to always say is that actually Black folks eat healthy. You know, that's our tradition. Our tradition is that the kinds of food that was unhealthy, we really mostly only ate on Sundays. And that as people got more money, they ate every day like it was Sunday. So if we can go back to those traditions of mostly vegetables, a little bit of meat, mostly fruit, and simple foods during the week, and the richer foods, if you have to have them once a week on Sunday, and get out and move and work. You know, as Dr. Morris said, those actually are our roots, and that's actually where we come from.
Dr. Morris.
So we can do that. And I think the other thing just, again, is that a part of our tradition, too, is that we fight and we advocate for change, and that many of us are involved in our schools and trying to make change. And so as much as we advocate for the kind of teaching, we also have to remember that our kids' academic progress is also tied to their access to physical education as well.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, our time has run out, and we'll have to end this conversation here. Hopefully, though, it will not be the last of these kinds of conversations that we offer to our audience, because the information that you are providing is so helpful and it is so very, very important. Makani Temba-Nixon is the executive director of the Praxis Project. She spoke to us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Alice Smith is the program director of child health promotion at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. And Dr. Sandra Moore is an assistant professor of clinical pediatrics at the Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. She joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Time now for a look at the world of sports, and what a week it has been. An NBA team gets humiliated. An MLB manager gets canned. An NFL player gets robbed. And a wounded tiger goes into hibernation. Okay, I know tigers don't hibernate, but you get the idea. Here to help me parse it all out is today's Sports Bloggers Roundtable, Greg Lee, senior online sports editor for the Boston Globe, and Chad Brown. He writes for alphablogsports.blogspot.com. So, gentlemen, let's start with the NBA Finals. LA basketball fans are still in a funk over that old-fashioned butt-whipping they got Tuesday night. A moment of silence, please. But in Beantown, it's been a day for parades, the first one for the Celtics in more than a generation. And Greg Lee, I know you are there in Boston. In fact, I think I saw you in the parade on TV, brother. What does this championship win mean to that city?
Well, I just saw schools of green all in the streets of Boston. They were everywhere. You know, it's the first time, you know, 22 years, like you said, winning a title. It's a new generation of, you know, of Celtics fans, a lot of young people out there. You know, this is, you know, as people say, this is not your grandfather Celtics. It's a, you know, different type of generation team. You know, of course, you're led by, everyone, when you think of the Celtics, you think of back in the 60s with Bill Russell and John Havlicek, and then in the 80s with Larry Bird and stuff. But now it's, you know, KG, Pierce, you know, Ray Allen, and Doc Rivers as the coach. And it's just different. This generation just really are just happy to see this team win a championship and celebrating in style today.
Well, Chad, the Celtics style of play seems something akin to hard-nosed, in-your-face street ball. Were they just too much for the Lakers to handle, too physical? Were the European players on the Lakers squad just not ready for that? What was it?
I think it was a mix. I mean, I think that the Lakers were overrated to an extent, but I think the Celtics were underrated. You have to understand, the Celtics went through numerous battles, whereas the Lakers breezed through what was supposed to be one of the toughest Western conferences ever. And that's not taken away from either side. But I think the Celtics, I think the Celtics just wanted it more. And that's stunning to say about a team with Kobe, guys like Kobe Bryant, Derek Fisher, and headed up by Phil Jackson. But I think the Celtics just wanted it more.
They certainly played like they wanted it more, didn't they?
No question. They were diving after every loose ball, everything. Even if one guy had an off night, you had two others who were stepping up. Meanwhile, it seemed like the Lakers were waiting around for Kobe. And I don't know what happened to Gasol or Lamar. They only showed up sporadically. Even when the Lakers won, you kind of felt like, well, I still think the Celtics are the better team. And as somebody from New York, that's very tough to say.
Somebody from L.A., it's really tough to hear. But, you know, what's right is right. Let me bring another question to you, Greg, about this before we go into another topic, because it's hard to talk about Boston being the world champions. Going into this series, many sports writers, as we just said, had the Lakers winning in five or six. Much for that. But you know what? There was once a racial element to the rivalry between the Celtics and Lakers, to be honest about it. But this series turned that racial dynamic on its head, didn't it?
Yeah, it's so funny. I have, like, people. I'm from New Orleans. I have a lot of people who hate the Celtics from the 80s. There's one guy, particularly my neighbor, couldn't stand the Celtics. Now he finds himself supporting the Celtics. Like I said before, the whole generation is different. Before, they thought of the Celtics as just being a white team. But now it's led by a black coach, predominantly black team. So I think, you know, a lot of people who had these biases of the Celtics from racial before, I've noticed a lot of people have, you know, changed. I didn't really care for Celtics growing up neither, but I can't help but, you know, support a team that plays actually great defense. And that's why the Lakers couldn't respond. They don't like getting hit in the mouth. The Celtics will hit you in the mouth, and they went to those battles. And, you know, respect people like Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen and Paul Pierce, and they're going through the battles this year. And I think, you know, the type of players they had on the team gravitated those who were Celtics haters in the 80s, and now they're Celtics supporters.
Absolutely. All right. Next year. Okay. Let's talk about baseball, Chad. You are there in New York City, and you know how baseball crazy that town can be. Willie Randolph became New York's first African-American baseball manager when he took the Mets job in 2004. This week, he was fired very unceremoniously in the wee hours of the morning while he was actually out here in California on a road trip to play the Angels. Now, there's been a lot of fallout from that firing, suggesting that the Mets and general manager Omar Minaya handled the whole thing very poorly. In fact, that's what Randolph himself said, not how he would have handled it. What's going on there now?
Well, as far as I can, let me just say this. There is no way to spin this thing positively. It was a horrible firing. I mean, 315, I'm thinking Mania has been watching too many Hillary Clinton commercials or something like that. But there's no good way to spin this. If you're going to fire him and you give him the whole Father's Day thing excuse, then do it before then. If it's not, and do it before the road trip. I mean, did he have to pay his own airfare back? I mean, fortunately, Willie has handled this thing with complete class, but it shows why the Mets are a second-class organization. But this is not the first time that a New York team has mishandled firing or fired somebody before then. You think about looking at football. I mean, the Giants would have been smart a few years ago to can Fossil after that collapse in San Francisco instead of giving him another 4-12 year. And as for the Jets, don't get me started on the missed field goals in Pittsburgh. Otherwise, we would have been spared the 4-12. Herm Edwards, we can only score 3 points. This all right. is all we got.
Stay with me now, Chaz. Stay okay, with sorry, me. Stay sorry. With me. All right. Let me.
I'm sorry about that. Okay. I apologize.
That's okay. One more thing about the Mets, and that's to you, Greg. And it may not have been the best way to fire him at 3 o'clock in New York time, 12 o'clock here. And we should say that it was after their game against the Angels. So it wasn't like he was awakened in the middle of the night and said, you're fired. But the real question is, did he deserve to be fired no matter what time of day it was?
Well, I think the problem was that the entire team felt the pressure for Willie. They pressed too much to try to keep his job. And that's a distraction. So did he deserve to lose his job? Maybe, but at the same time, it is a distraction. It's still a cloud that was hovering over the team's head, and I think they were pressing. So just rather just keep really there. It's just time to just cut the relationship now and let the players not be stressed out about it. And not just and hopefully they get out of their funk and not press anymore because they have an interim manager and they're not going to be pressured to to perform. So I think that Willie did a good job, but at the same time, it still was a cloud over the head for the players, and it was a big distraction. They really like Willie, but they try too hard.
All right.
And it hurt.
I don't even play golf, but I was glued to the television this past week when we saw one of the most remarkable performances by one of the most remarkable guys in sports, Tiger Woods, of course, on one leg, winning the U.S. Open at Torrey Pines in a dramatic sudden-death playoff.
Yeah.
14th major, third U.S. Open victory, but he's hurt. And now he says he's going to back off the tour for the rest of the year so he can have more work done on that bum knee of his. Did you see it, Chad?
I saw bits and pieces. It was unbelievable what I saw. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Now, what do you think about him taking off and what the impact will have on the rest of the tour?
Well, it's his long-term health, so he pretty much has to take off. I don't know what – I think people will still watch, but it won't be the same. At the same time, no Tiger means that you've got an open field. You really don't know what's going to happen. And in any sport, there's got to have some level of excitement. But without Tiger, it'll be a letdown. But people will still watch, just not in droves.
I don't know. Do you think people will watch, Greg, unless you're already a golf fan?
You're a golf fan, and the biggest impact is going to be on the Ryder Cup. That's this year, and Tiger's not on the Ryder Cup. Will people be glued to the TV to watch the United States go against the Europeans in the every other year tournament later this year? That's going to be a tough thing. I probably won't watch it because Tiger's not there. I mean, I was glued to the TV on the airplane, coming back from Los Angeles to Boston, and I was dead tired, but I watched the 16 holes I can watch on TV on the airplane. And but without Tiger, I don't know if I would have been glued to the set. I probably would have been asleep. So I think that I'm not the biggest golf fan, but those who are like me, which is most of America, when they watch golf and they want to see Tiger.
That's true.
It's going to hurt.
You know, it's interesting. The Tiger thought that he was going to be able to win four majors in a row in a calendar year for the first time. And we know what happened at Augusta, which shot the whole thing. That made this comeback win at Torrey Pines just even more incredible, didn't it?
It was his golf course. It's basically one of it. He's dominated at Torrey Pines, and he saw this opportunity as the United States Open. This is one of the most important tournaments to him because it's in his home state. It's also the United States National Championship, and he wanted to prove something, and he wanted to get out there and prove that he can still do this. And the United States Open is not always going to be played at Torrey Pines, so he thought this would be the opportunity to add another major to his collection.
The guy who went away and nobody remembers, Phil Mickelson. He was supposed to win. That's his home city, as a matter of fact, San Diego as well.
Exactly.
Too bad for him, but Too bad for golf fans who wanted to see Tiger. All right, we have one more subject for a sports bloggers roundtable today. And, you know, it's strange. We never talk about NFL players getting in trouble. But here's another one.
No.
Javon Walker. On Monday, the Oakland Raiders wide receiver found unconscious on a Las Vegas street. He had been beaten badly, robbed following a night of clubbing and partying. But what may have precipitated this whole incident, Chad, are reports that Walker was flossing and spraying expensive champagne at patrons at a nightclub. Now, one more thing before you respond. This comes after another late-night problem involving him. In 2007, he was sitting in a limousine when shots were fired into the vehicle. His then Denver Broncos teammate, Darrent Williams, was killed and died in his arms. So what's he doing hanging out at the club still?
Well, I don't think you're ever going to get these guys away from the club. I mean, we've had, and I will stay on topic here, I promise. We've had other instances in Vegas of NFL players getting in trouble. So you can only, as Lane Kiffin said, you can only educate them so much. You can't babysit them. So guys are still going to go to Vegas. It's a shame of what happened with Javon, who the incident you mentioned, since the Darrent Williams case, he really has not seemed to be the same person.
You know, cash and celebrity seem to be a deadly mixture for a growing number of athletes, Greg. Doesn't the league warn these guys about the streets?
They warn that they have these symposiums before the season, you know, with the rookies, with the veterans, and also they still do it. I mean, Javon was, you know, flossing big diamond earring studs. He was really flossing. He had a big, big diamond-encrusted watch on him, and it was flashing. And people, you know, if you're going to show that off, you're a target for people. And then what made matters worse, he was spraying, you know, champagne on people, you know, kind of like Pac-Man Jones making it rain with a dollar bill.
15 bottles.
Bottles of Dom Perignon.
Yeah, he signed a big contract with the Raiders. The Raiders gave him a lot of money, a big signing bonus. So, hey, he was celebrating in Las Vegas before, I guess, training camp starts in a couple of weeks.
If he'll be ready for training
camp.
He won't be ready. And, you know, Al Davis and Coach Lane Kiffin are definitely not happy about the investment they put in him, which when he signed in the first place, I shook my head at what they gave him.
You know, we've got to run out of here in less than a minute, but don't these guys have bodyguards? If you're going to bling all over the place, don't you have some backup with you normally?
Well, they should, but I'm guessing when they go out, you know, they kind of tend to leave the common sense at home. You know?
Yes, exactly, especially when they go out in Las Vegas like that.
Well, anyone goes out in Las Vegas.
Yeah, they keep their bodyguards away for the most part when they go to Las Vegas, unless you're like Michael Jordan. He'll have bodyguards all around because he's Michael Jordan, but he's not going to go out like what Javon Walker did. So that's why Javon Walker doesn't have his bodyguards around, because he's just going to do whatever.
Well, I might want to rethink that.
I hope he recovers from this. You know, we don't want anyone to be injured, but at the same time, it's like, man, you got to figure out what you're doing. Guys, it's always good to have you on. Greg Lee, senior online sports editor for the Boston Globe, joined us by phone from somewhere in Boston after that crazy parade. And Chad Brown, he writes for alphablogsports.blogspot.com. He joined us from our New York bureau. Gentlemen, thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be on here.
And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. How are you?
Absolutely fabulous. Thank you. We got some praise, I understand, for the interview we aired last week with Zimbabwe's opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai.
Listener Candace Francis wrote in to say, kudos to Farai Chidea and her staff for getting this very informative and moving interview. My only question is, why wasn't it picked up by All Things Considered for the evening broadcast? If not in full, then excerpted at least. What is happening in Zimbabwe is heartbreaking, but this was a wonderful opportunity to hear from Morgan Tsvangirai, who demonstrated that the depiction of African zealots is not the only portrait of leaders on this diverse continent. I know this took a lot of tenacity and hard work to get this interview, so kudos to all of you again.
And last week, we did a series on the black leadership. In one segment, we interviewed James Rucker of The Color of Change and Charles Steele, Jr. of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference on how community leaders were passing the torch of leadership. Daryl Cox in Seattle, Washington, no relation, wrote us this. I found the three segments News and Notes did on the issue of black leadership to be embarrassingly bad in terms of your guests and the extremely superficial way in which the topic was covered. James Rucker's presence, in my opinion, was simply wasted. There are serious problems with black leadership, and the so-called generational divide that News and Notes and others have fastened onto obscures rather than illuminates the problems.
Another listener, Willie Porter, said he was disappointed when he heard Farai say this.
More than a week ago, Reverend Jeremiah Wright was supposed to step down as senior pastor of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. That's the church from which Senator Barack Obama resigned his membership. Reverend Otis Moss III was already handpicked to take over at the pulpit, but in a last-minute move, Reverend Wright decided the 37-year-old minister wasn't ready.
He wrote in to say this, Ms. Chidea started the show informing listeners that Reverend Wright had decided not to retire and is having a hard time passing over the authority of the church. What bothers me so much that a phone call to Trinity United Church of Christ could have prevented the miscommunication of these facts. Well, we based that report on a Time magazine article titled The Unretirement of Reverend Wright. We did call the Trinity United Church of Christ, and a spokeswoman said the article was incorrect. Reverend Wright now has the title of Pastor Emeritus. Reverend Otis Moss III holds the title Senior Pastor Elect. A church statement says Moss is expected to be installed as the church's pastor this fall.
And finally, a few weeks ago, we had a listener write in to say she did not like our sports segments. Michael Strode in Chicago, Illinois, wrote in to say he's been a fan for the last 2 years. Although some of my fellow listeners have taken offense with the sports segment, I enjoy the way that Tony Cox, Bill Roden, and your other bloggers and journalists are able to cut through the fray of the usual sports coverage and interject the politics of the day in the mix. Keep pressing forward in other areas that add new dimensions to your programming, as you may just find another that I was not aware that I would enjoy. Thank you, Michael.
And that's it for letters. Thank you for writing, and please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thanks for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.